Good morning.
Saying it is God's, but that God is found within it. If Torah is not perfect, then whose authority is brought to its interpretation? I understand that if Torah is perfect, that the authority rests outside of me. It rests in Torah as an authoritative document in and of itself. But if Torah is not perfect, then where is the authority? And Reform Judaism talks a lot about the notion of autonomy, that it is my responsibility to go to Torah to find truth, value, and the path, the halakha, the right way of traveling with God, toward God. And so within Reform Judaism, it is my responsibility to become the authority. If authority does not lie in Torah, then what right do I have as a rabbi or as anyone to tell another Reformed Jew what Torah means? Once we say that autonomy rests within the individual, it is not within my prerogative to declare for someone else where authority lies. It is very much a black and white issue. One is either pregnant or not pregnant. Torah is either divine or it's not divine. And once one makes that first statement, then authority then rests with the individual. And therefore, different rabbis, different synagogues, different Reformed Jews and different Reformed communities will interpret values differently because we understand that autonomy and authority rest within the community. Going back to the other question about, yes, values change, does that mean that Judaism changes? And my answer is yes, indeed, that we have our human society and culture has gone through a number of changes. And that's part of being human, that's part of growing, that's part of this whole notion of God blessing us with knowledge and minds to consider. And so, yes, there will be values that will be different. It wasn't so long ago that women couldn't become rabbis in Reform Judaism. And it wasn't so long ago that you could not wear a kippah. My first congregation, as rabbi, I was not allowed to wear a kippah in that congregation. That congregation has changed. Reform Judaism has changed. And we are always in the process of challenging ourselves with values, with principles, in order to make the Jewish life of our community, of my community, relevant and meaningful. And so, yes, we're talking about picking and choosing. And one can only hope that over the course of time, over the course of the life of a community or an individual, that we settle on those values that become identified as true.
Did you want to respond to that?
No, I could have said it better.
Arnie? I've got, had his hand up before you.
A little louder, Arnie.
I have a question. I'm concerned about the use of the word written in our tradition versus divine mandate. Tradition implies to me that there's an ability for flexibility. It's a tradition. It's heavy as tradition. And, well, we do it. I think perhaps in theological academics, it's probably more a term of art, but you mentioned tradition. And you use it as divine mandate. For example, you have traditions that they're tweakable. I understand something about those public words the boundaries of the
Eruv.
Do you view that as a tweaking of the tradition to accommodate modern life in our
There's an entire tractate called Eruvin in the Talmud, which defines what is an Eruv and what is not. So, no, not at all. That was
like,
what is an Eruv? An Eruv is a structure that's built around the community in order to call it a private, a reshut hayachid, individual domain. For example, if I live in a public domain, what is not permitted to carry on the Shabbos? So women can't use their strollers, I can't carry my talis, etc., etc. That is one of the prohibitions of the Sabbath. You're not allowed to carry in a public domain. So therefore, we build, as a community, we build what's called an Eruv, An eruv means an enclosure, which halakhically, which legally encloses the community so that we can now carry. Sometimes you'll notice the eruv in our community, unless you know what to look for, you won't notice it.
It's
a whole tractate in the Talmud, and it was something that was not a tweak, it was always built into the tradition. It was something that halakha allowed for.
Kevin?
Yes.
I have a question about kashrut. And when you're talking about Rabbi Spolker, when you're talking about the eternal tradition, it seems to me that there should be one rule. But when you look at kashrut, there are differences, whether it's an Ashkenaz or a Sephard Pesach rule, whether it's full of Yisrael dairy or regular dairy certified by the OU, Lubavitch or slaughtered meat versus regular slaughtered meat. How could there be so many differences, but yet Orthodox tradition be eternal?
I don't know what that means. That's a good question. That's a very good question.
Cultural differences within the law.
No. The question was, how can there be so many different traditions of what's kosher when kashrut is supposed to be something that's divine and eternal? It's a very, very good question. The real question comes out that in rabbinic Judaism, there isn't always one voice. The rabbis have the ability to dispute what is the definition of such and such, what's considered kosher or non-kosher. You know, everyone agrees about the basis. What's a kosher animal? What's a non-kosher animal? And if you'd ask me, 99% of things in kosher they agree on. But when it comes to specific issues, then they disagree about very, very specific things. What's lubavitch or shechita versus non-lubavitch or shechita? It's really very, very specific nuances. You ever notice that we tend to fight about the biggest minutia? You know, we tend to argue about the smaller things and not about the bigger things. So what you have then is a dispute in rabbinic tradition about what is the definition of such and such a terminology in the Talmud, in the Mishnah, etc., etc. Now, I'm not being as clear as I possibly can be, but I'm trying. In addition, when it comes to kashrut, when it comes to any area of Jewish life, of ritual life, some people try to be more stringent and as restrictive as they can be in the definitions, in the Torah definitions. So therefore, some people will only eat, like you say, Chal of Israel. I'm not going to go into what the definition of that is, because they want to be more stringent. They feel that they have to be more careful upon themselves, whereas other people will rely upon a leniency of certain rabbis. But they all fall under the rubric. Nobody will tell you that regular non-Chal of Israel is not kosher, that the OU is not kosher. They'll say, I maintain a higher standard for myself. And I think that that's something that's important to remember. But that's a very good question. Somebody else also asked, what does it mean to be a modern Orthodox? What does that mean? See, it's interesting. You'll notice, and I spoke about this before, Orthodoxy very often comes in conflict with the values of American society. Open up any newspaper, you know, any television program, any radio show, any movie, those things have values that conflict with what Jewish society teaches us. So some people feel, and you know, to be honest with you, not wrongfully so, that the best way to protect ourselves from the influences of society which conflict with the values that we hold dear is to build a wall around our Jewish society, maybe not necessarily a physical wall, but a separation between us and the society which surrounds us. Because I got to be honest with you, I mean, those who were in my Shul B'Shabes, I gave a drasha about the internet. Now, I do have to tell you, how many people have internet access in their homes? Does anybody know, well, of course, how many pornographic websites there are on the internet today?
429.
About 70. Exactly, you know exactly.
After careful research.
Over 75,000. You get one of those a day for the rest of your life and you wouldn't even come close. And we bring that into our homes. Now, I'm not going to ask the kids here today, but if you would ask the kids, how many of you have seen a pornographic website? I dare say some of them have. So now, is that something we want to expose our children to? Is that something we want them to have access to? No sane person would say yes. So now, my brother-in-law is what you would call, quote-unquote, ultra-Orthodox. My sister does not have internet access in her home. She won't even consider it. even though she's a graphic designer, and she could stand to make a great deal of money by having access to email. She could work and send over the email. But she refuses to have it in her home because, let's be honest, her 10-year-old would be clamoring for it. But she doesn't want it in her home. Modern Orthodox people feel that we walk a very fine line. On the one hand, I try to maintain my identity as an Orthodox Jew. But on the other hand, I don't cower from the things in society that have value. So does the internet have value? I believe that it does. For example, you could go to my website, www.spolter.net. Write that down.
You're a quarter owner?
And you could listen to this, maybe this class. You could listen to Torah classes given by myself and my wife. You could download articles that I've written. There's so much Torah on the internet. But there's so much garbage on the internet as well. So someone who's ultra-Orthodox says, it's not worth it. I don't have television. I don't have internet. Because those values are unbelievably dangerous. And they are. You can't argue. But someone who's not an Orthodox would say, I take that which is good, and I reject that which is not good. And I tell you, that's a very, very hard line to tell. And sometimes we fail.
Gentlemen, the glasses.
How long do we have? How long is this thing going to go?
That's maximum.
I am not a member of
these
kinds of
congregations,
but recently my grandson had a frisk with my son-in-law's daughter about Orthodox. And I was told, because I drive on Saturday, I am considered personally, I am not spiritually beneficial for my son's future because I drive on Saturday. And I felt that you're putting a block in front of me. You are not letting me be part of my grandson.
Well, don't tell me. I didn't say that. No, I think it's very important, but I think it's a very important distinction. I didn't say that.
No, I didn't say that.
I'm saying, but someone told you. Okay, go ahead.
A rabbi from the Hillel advised my son-in-law not to give me any honor at my grandson Chris because I drive on Saturdays and I am not spiritually beneficial to his future. Now, I love my religion, I love my family, I love everything, my neighbors, I'm a hard worker, I've been law-abiding,
let me ask you, did you ask your son-in-law about this?
Yes, I did.
And what did he say?
He said that Rabbi Hillel said, because I drive on Saturday, I am not permitted any honor at the crisp. And that I don't think as far as he's concerned, me and my family, when it came over, we were like to the flock in front of us at
See, but interesting. He was about to say you're, okay? He did say you're. And I understand your predilection. Now, what I would say to you is, I feel bad for you, and I don't necessarily agree with that. What? Yeah, but I'm not his rabbi. And so it doesn't matter.
You are his rabbi. He goes to your congregation. He goes to Israel.
He has to listen. I'm not going to get into specific cases, I have to tell you. But if you want to talk to me privately about that, that's a different story. But I would say this. I would say on the one hand, he's trying to raise his children to value Shmirat Shabbat, keeping of Shabbat. At the same time, I believe that we have to raise our children to have respect and honor for their parents and their grandparents, and to try to find a way of doing both.
A little louder, Jeff.
It seems to me, the human beings as a whole, depending on the distinction that we have, very often look for something that is unchanging. In other words, a set value that is immutable for all. There are some people who need structure and need to sort of think and really commonly will survive. And there are other people who really feel that people are quote unquote flexible and have their own sort of values that they'd rather live in. And so we have sort of theories that can be Jews, but the fact of the matter is Orthodox is sort of one person that wants the structure to reform Judaism, but these also people that do not feel wanted or don't need it.
Yeah.
Let me try and restate that, Jeff, so that people can hear. All of us look for foundational principles, something firm on which we can stand, some basis that we can live our lives. And I guess the question was, how does Reform deal with that, and how does Orthodoxy deal with that, and the difference, yes?
Well, yeah, I think it's clear how to deal with it. I think the Orthodoxy is that sort of the rules of this stuff,
right. I think I'm going to respond by saying that we both do it exactly the same way. The one immutable proof for God that I have, for me, is that I know that there are certain truths that transcend humanity and transcend everything else. I believe that it is wrong to murder, for instance. Not simply because I think it's wrong, because I think it's a bad thing. I think that murder is wrong. I think that adultery is wrong. I think that stealing is wrong. And I believe that those are values that transcend humanity, transcend society, and transcend history. That all of those are true, not because I think so or because we think so, but because they are capital T true. Having made that statement, how then do I understand where that truth came from? There has to be a transcendent, universal source from which these truths come. I can only posit it as God. That's how I identify it. And so, yes, I think there are fundamental, absolute truths that we must strive to understand, that we hang our lives on, or set our lives on, depending on your metaphor. What differentiates us is how we find it. I think that I find those truths through my Jewish study and my Jewish heritage. I think that Judaism preserves and protects those truths, those transcendent truths, better than any other system, and speaks of those truths in ways better than any other religious system, and that's why I'm Jewish. But all of us as Jews are looking for God's message, those truths of behavior, of justice and righteousness and peace. All of us are looking for those truths in the same place. But we are using different tools to find them.
But you think those truths, the majority of those do not have those same truths, but doesn't have the same religion. So there's arrogance that I find on the Orthodox saying that this is the only truth that can be in play for Jews. I agree with you that there are transcendent truths. I'm not sure I agree with the idea of
And I don't know that Judaism, and I would not say that Judaism is the only source from which those truths might be found, either.
Why don't we let Rabbi Spolter respond?
The Orthodox, first of all, Judaism is the only religion in the world that believes that not everybody has to be Jewish. It believes that Jews have to be Jewish. So while these truths might, we agree that this is revelation, these objective truths in God and all of that, the restrictions and the way to live my life is only for us Jews. So I don't see that as arrogance, I see that as self-confidence.
Jeff,
hold on one second. I said that Reform Judaism, I do not believe is a legitimate form of Judaism. That's correct. I would hope you would think that I would think that. Because otherwise, what am I doing? I don't believe in anything. I don't understand how anybody could believe otherwise. You have to believe what you believe is the correct thing. Otherwise, you don't believe in your form of religion. And I don't think that's arrogance. I think that's education. I think that I'm raised to believe in a certain tradition. And I'm not arrogance of saying, that's me and you guys don't know anything. I'm saying that this tradition has been taught to me and I've given it a great deal of thought and a great deal of study, an ongoing study, to have the belief and the knowledge that what I say is true. And if what I say is true and we're saying different things, then I can't believe that what Rabbi Klein is saying is true. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Well, there's no one.
Yes. You've been patient.
I read a novel that was written by an Orthodox person that said,
house than there's left on this
Women are not allowed to say kaddish. Now, that's the question. Are women not permitted to say kaddish? The answer is that a woman does not count towards the quorum for a minyan, for a religious minyan. And really, usually, only those people who count for a quorum in the minyan can take part in a public pronouncement such as the kaddish. So therefore, it's not a woman is not permitted to say kaddish, but a woman does not say kaddish for the shuls. Very often, not very often, every now and then a woman will say kaddish, but privately behind the mechitza. And I'm not going to stop her, but that's not part of the service as it is. Absolutely not. Why? Because her role is not to say kaddish in a public forum. Does it say that God doesn't hear her prayers? All that says is that her role is something, and it isn't the public role in the synagogue. God definitely does hear her prayers, probably louder than he hears mine. It depends on how much intent she has and what her connection to God is. But an Orthodox woman doesn't see that as a shortcoming, that her role is to pray to God as an individual, not necessarily in public in the community. Again, we relate it to public things as the most important things in American society. Therefore, just because we say Kaddish in public, and it's a public thing said in shul, we consider that important. I don't agree with that. I think that a woman's connection to God depends very much on her prayers as an individual, and doesn't necessarily hinge on whether she can say Kaddish or not.
Steve?
I'm Steve Fletcher. I'm a member of Temple Emmanuel, and I was bar mitzvah at Young Israel of Farfrae many years ago.
He's both sides, right?
And since I'm comfortable praying it in either mode, davening in either mode, my question is one of liturgy. John is down, so I don't garble it. Rabbi Spalter, I'd like to comment on the Orthodox rationale for freezing the liturgy in place around the 15th or 16th century after many centuries of creative development. Haven't we lost the intervening centuries of creativity and insight regarding both Teva and Shemana?
Such as what?
Well, we don't know.
Now, Matthew, what is the last thing that was changed?
I think it was pretty much from the Hasidic movement was pretty much the end of changes in the prayer form. I mean, it was 9th and 10th century. It was pretty much put down in written form. But it continued to develop a little bit. There were other poems and things added. But it pretty much, the last 400 or 500 years, been locked in place, and in fact, it can't change anymore. The other half of it is, conversely, I'd like Rabbi Klein to comment on the reform rationale for doing away with huge chunks of the liturgy and inventing completely new forms. Hasn't this led to a breakdown in prayer form and intention across the broader Reform community, since any synagogue or any temple can create its own prayers?
Okay, the question was, in Orthodoxy, how come there's not more flexibility in the liturgy? Now, sometimes I feel, this might be a little controversial, sometimes I feel that in Orthodoxy we say too much. If you ever go to an Orthodox synagogue, we start with Sukkot and Zimran, we're reciting psalm after psalm, and then there's Shacharit, and then there's Shemona Esrei, and Musaf, and it's very, very hard to concentrate on all of these things. It really is. It's hard to focus on everything that you're saying. And something that I and every Jew, I think, struggles with, having concentration. At the same time, Steve, what I will say to you is that the main parts of the davening, the Shema and the Shemona Esrei and the blessings surrounding them, those haven't changed really at all, and those are pretty uniform except for specific wordages between Ashkenaz and Sfar. Those have been universal for centuries and centuries. And I'll say the following: the rabbis, when they codified this Shemona Esrei, and it is brought down in the Talmud, so they didn't say this for centuries and centuries, they had specific aspects that I think related to human prayer, to the human condition, that we needed to relate to. And I think that the more you study prayer, the more you'll understand that there is flexibility within the format. See, when you look at the liturgy, the problem with writing down a certain text that you have to say is, the more I tell you have to say, the less you're going to think about it when you say it. Because all I got to do is say these words. But if I don't tell you have to say anything, what's eventually going to happen? You're going to say nothing. Because, oh, I feel like praying today, I don't feel like praying tomorrow. So they had to, there's a balance. How do I get you to pray, but I get you to think about what you're saying? Because just saying the words and having no idea what you're saying is no communication with God at all. You've got to know what you're saying. So to that end, I would encourage you to come to my SAGE class at the JCC on Thursday mornings if you look at your SAGE thing.
What time is it?
8 o'clock.
I would start out exactly the same way Rabbi Stolter did. Sometimes orthodoxy does too much. and then I would echo that all liturgy is a balance. It's a balancing act. The Reform movement has always built its liturgy on both keva and kavanah. Keva meaning that which is set, ordained, regular, expected, and kavanah, intentional, of the moment, from the heart. In our worship service, there is only one Reader's Kaddish, for instance. In a traditional worship service, the Reader's Kaddish, the Chetzi Kaddish, serves as a semicolon between sections of the worship service. It divides different sections of the worship service. And in our tradition, our movement has always said, you know, when you say it, that's enough. We don't need to say it over and over again. We already understand the divisions of the sections, and I will put the Reader's Kaddish before the Baruch Hu. I go to Orthodox services on Shabbat morning, and just when I think we've gotten through the service, you know, son of a gun, we're doing the Amidah again. Well, I've already done it once. I find no value, speaking very personally now, I find no value in doing Shemona Esrei, Tefillah, the prayer of Amidah, a second time. I don't find value in that. And so in our services, not just because I don't think so, but the Reform movement has moved in that direction, we do the Tefillah only once. But there is a serious issue in the flexibility in worship. Because unless worship is regular, unless it contains Shema, Shemona Esrei, unless it contains those elements of what Jewish worship ought to be, there is no commonality and there is no community. It is very important for me to go to another synagogue and hear those prayers. It is important for me to invest in our children not only the knowledge of those prayers, but how they function and where they function and what they sound like and what they mean, because I want them to be comfortable wherever they go. And I'm not at all comfortable in saying, the Shema doesn't work for me today, so I'm not going to use it. On the other hand, within our movement, we can say, well, you know, maybe we'll do the Shema a little differently. Maybe we'll sing it with a different tune. Maybe we'll take a little longer in doing it. So the Reform movement certainly puts flexibility and will make additions and will certainly make subtractions. And we walk this balancing line of making worship meaningful, but preserving the integrity of what that tradition ought to be so that it's recognizable and fulfilling, at least for me personally, as worship, as what Jewish worship is.
You need to stand up and speak loudly.
I'm Leah Chalitsky. I'm from Temple Emmanuel. And what's Shemona Esrei?
Oh, good question. Shemona Esrei is the Amidah. Shemona Esrei literally means 18, although it's really 19. Right. The blessings that are said in the Amidah on a daily basis three times a day. That's Shemona Esrei. Thank you for asking.
Yes.
By the way, when you say, and our kids say, we rise for the prayer of Tefillah, Tefillah, Shemona Esrei, or Amidah. It's all the same.
Shemona Esrei is 18, Amidah is 19.
Rabbi, I really do enjoy you, and I'm sorry I burst out before, because I'm stuck. So I have two questions.
A little louder.
I'm stuck!
Thank you.
The first thing I'm stuck on is the gentleman whose son-in-law is it? His daughter married this wonderful man. Well, he must be a wonderful man. He told his father-in-law that, you know, he was not to be honored because he drives on the Shabbat. My question is, where does honor your father come into that? Now, second one. We have friends here in this congregation whose two daughters married into ultra-Orthodox life. So they have excluded their own parents from many, many events because their parents are Reformed Jews. Case in point, the children of these families go to private schools where they do not celebrate any American holidays. Therefore, the grandparents of these children cannot have a Thanksgiving with them because there ain't no such animal in their house, so they have it on another day. They don't have a 4th of July, they don't have Memorial Day. All of the American things where these kids were brought up no longer exist. So this family here has to really concentrate and bend over, triple backwards, so they can have some meaningful time with their children. Why is this family, the ones that belong to that ultra-Orthodox thing, why do they feel that in order to be good Jews, they have to absolutely eliminate everything that's American?
I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, you know, I personally, we don't celebrate Thanksgiving because that wasn't something we did in my household, but I've been to Thanksgiving dinners, and I think they're wonderful, and I think that every American should have great civic pride in this wonderful country in which we are blessed to live. And I think that that's something that all of us should feel. And I can't answer that question. You know, you're asking me why do people, I think, make mistakes in judgment? I don't know, but I can't answer for them, and I don't think I should have to.
It's based on sukkahs.
Now, I would say, though, to that family, I don't think it's bending over backwards for them to call up and say, we would like to go out and celebrate Hanukkah as a family together. Can we go out to dinner and milk and honey?
Well, they do that.
So then they can find meaningful family time. So I understand your question about the American holidays, but at the same time, there are certainly many, many opportunities throughout the year for the family to get together and celebrate as a family.
Hi, I'm Al Asher, and I'm a member of this congregation. Rabbi Salter, I'm delighted with the conversation we're having this morning. I think it's been very valuable for all of us. I wonder, though, are you going to invite a Reform rabbi to educate your congregation on the precepts of Reform Judaism?
The answer is, as we spoke at the beginning, Rabbi Klein views Rabbi Salter as one of the legitimate forms of Judaism. So therefore, it's important for me to come and talk about different types of revelation. Whereas Rabbi Salter does not view Rabbi Klein's view as one of the legitimate forms of Judaism, so therefore I would not invite him to come and speak in my congregation. It isn't because I don't value him as a friend, and it isn't because I don't value him as a Jew, but I don't value the Judaism that he teaches as a legitimate form of Judaism.
I don't think I should be ashamed.
I think that it's something that I believe in strongly, and I would appreciate the fact that I would appreciate people respecting that which I believe in.
One people, two worlds. Assuming you might have read it.
I read some of it. I didn't find it so motivating, to be honest with you.
But it was very interesting what is going on here as compared to the book. Three things struck me. One of them was conscience and the law, labeling conscience and the law and the absolute. Can you comment on that, especially conscience and the law as related to religion?
I don't understand the question. I'm sorry.
I'm afraid that we need the grounding in particular books, so I'm going to move on to...
Let me just wait one.
Norman's comment was about the book, One People, Two Worlds, written by a Reform rabbi and an Orthodox rabbi. Their email correspondence. To my knowledge, they have sat down at the same table, but the book was not that. It was email correspondence. By the way, it's our congregational read for this year. I'm asking everybody in the congregation to read it. And the question was specifically about issues within that book, and I don't even know that I could answer that specifically, even though I thoroughly recommend it. I think it is written very well from both rabbis. I think it's worth the read. I don't know if you want to say anything.
Yeah. I bought the book.
A little louder, please.
And I also have, I think, the unique privilege to be able to engage in discourse each week with approximately 150 Jews, one of whom is an Orthodox Jew. most all the rest either consider themselves, consider themselves as poor Jews, extreme Jews, those who have stated they're not in their community. I'd like to make a couple observations in this discussion here, as well as make a challenge. I think the first observation is looking around and feeling a bit lonely. Feeling a bit lonely, and that Rabbi Spalter and I, the best of my knowledge, which began a while ago, are the only Orthodox Jews here.
Here I am.
Okay. We're still very few numbers. And while this is a program that's been sponsored by Temple Emanuel, it was well advertised in the community. And I think very sad about it that there are so few Orthodox Jews present. I think, though, that part of the reason, and I think personally this is the greatest thing that divides, creates obstacles in the discourse between Orthodoxy and Reform Judaism, is not so much the theological issues, but those we can, in good faith with great intellect and knowledge, argue and agree to disagree as we started. But I think for the most part they're sociological issues, and they are education or knowledge-based issues. I think one of the things that divides ideas in my classes weekly, I won't say divides, but jumps out at me, is the tremendous lack of basic Jewish knowledge in the Jewish world outside of Orthodoxy. I have many students who can read Torah, but yet don't know what Torah says. They have wonderful, I grew up in a conservative movement, where given synagogue skills, as they were called. There are many people who have very well developed synagogue skills, but yet don't know what Torah says. And surprising to me, very often, don't know what the form of Judaism says about the Torah. If I'll quote to them, I respond to the written by Rabbi Saul Freeman, who I saw when he got excuse me. They won't know who he is. They don't even know who the prophet is. So I'm not sure how we can have this discourse when there's such a great disparity in the educational levels between the average Orthodox Jew, just a basic knowledge of Judaism, not the things that you disagree about, the basic knowledge of Judaism, of our basic texts. And I guess that's my challenge.
Keep it brief. We have a lot of
other questions. Yes, I apologize. The issue of women's issues, women's participation. And while I agree with many things that my small group said, the basic difference between the way Orthodoxy looks at women's role in its manifestation, not the idea state, its manifestation, is again knowledge-based. Because the indeed changes that are happening in the Orthodox world in terms of the role of women is coming through knowledge. The change has been in women studying, women studying Talmud, women studying Torah, women becoming, assuming roles of elected advisors for women, women in Israel serving as rabbinical pleaders, or pleaders on behalf of children, so to speak, to be
I'm sorry, but we really need to let other people...
My challenge is that I think we need to find opportunities in this community for Orthodox and Reformed Jews to get together and to learn together and not just talk about these issues. That's what we're going to do.
Okay.
I'm ready for a question. I'm ready for a question.
Jen?
I've been studying Reform and Orthodox Judaism for a little while, and I'm having trouble with what you're saying about your interpretation of Oral Torah. You mentioned that Oral Torah reflects God's original intent for humanity, but you also stated that Talmud is rabbinical interpretation over the generations. And my question goes along with the story of in Talmud of Rabbi Eliezer trying to convince his colleagues about the cleanliness of a specific oven, and it ends with that Torah is not in heaven anymore, and the emphasis that Judaism, the Jewish vision, places on interpreting and debating.
Correct. God does gave the rabbis tool from which to divine, from which to derive the will of the tradition. And once those tools are in man's hands, then God doesn't, in the story, I mean, I don't want to go through the whole story, it's a great story, but God does give, it is rabbinic Judaism as it is stated. But that doesn't mean that rabbis, that I as a rabbi can come along and say whatever I want. Meaning, who made me a rabbi? The person that made me a rabbi was a rabbi before him, which means I have fealty, I have an obligation to uphold the rabbinics that they gave into me. If I come along and say, well, you know, I happen to disagree with all those things that the rabbis told me, and one doesn't have to keep Shabbat, or I can make up my own definitions, then by my own definition, I'm no longer a rabbi. Because the whole authority vested in me is based upon the authority that was that they have from their generations. So I guess what I'm trying to describe to you is, yes, it is a rabbinic Judaism, but it's a rabbinic Judaism that has an obligation to the parameters that were established by the rabbis before then.
So it's not divine. Like that's not having trouble with the interpretation that you're giving. If it's rabbinic interpretation on top of rabbinic interpretation throughout the generation, and if God laughed because his children had prevailed over him.
Right, but using the tools only within the parameters which he had established.
Is there a difference between rabbinic interpretation?
I understand what you're saying. It's a very, very good question. But God gave certain tools and certain parameters, and within those parameters, the rabbis had leeway to establish what the tradition was going to be.
The guidelines.
They defined the parameters. The parameters of the rabbis who were using the tools that were within the parameters.
I disagree. I think that God defined the parameters.
Well, still first-time questions.
Now,
a little louder.
You cannot speak without speaking within a specific language, so the grammar and the structure and the rules of specific language may create problems in understanding what was intended. And Hebrew, as in formal English, when you're talking about a group of people, you have the tendency to use the masculine, and so it can be difficult to understand what the topic you discussed was intended to refer only to men, or whether in fact it applies to both men and women, because you don't say he and she, you just say he. And so there's a whole possibility there that things that may have been intended to be applied more broadly to all of humanity or all of Jewish humanity may have been interpreted by the rabbis as applicable only to men because of the grammatical thing that when it says he, does it mean he, or does it mean he or she? We're talking generically about any theoretical person.
The rabbis discussed each case in the Talmud extensively and decided when they believed that it applied to men and when they believed that it applied universally. So they do address that language issue.
Question. It's about how the rabbis have interpreted, particularly the interpretation of Shas. What precludes modern rabbis from continuing to interpretation and have
that
use the
tradition
to move forward from?
I think Orthodoxy continues to do that. And I can say that because I'm not part of it. Every rabbinic court deals with these issues. From our vantage point, the change is very, very slow. We don't see changes in how halacha is applied. But I think it does happen. It doesn't happen in the quality or the quantity that satisfies me. But I think it does happen.
I believe that I, as a rabbi, stand upon the shoulders of those rabbis who came before me. And that we believe also that the closer a person was to the revelation, the closer they were to the original rabbinic intent. So therefore, the farther away I am, the less understanding or the less authority I have vis-a-vis that original authority. So therefore, you will find almost never, there are some exceptions, but almost never will a rabbi take a halachic disagreement and disagree with the rabbi that came in a period, in a rabbinic period that came before that. So you'll ask me, to be honest with you, one of the great things that we don't have today is rabbinic unity. We don't have a Sanhedrin. We don't have a court of law, a great court of law. And that's something that really precludes us from enacting, as you would say, rabbinic legislation, reenacting. There is no more Sanhedrin. And that's a function of the fact that we live in exile. We live with the destruction of the temple. There is no unified Jewish community. And until we have that, we're bound by the decrees and rabbinic ordinances that were established when we did have that.
Question regarding the Torah. The Reform and the Orthodox lift the Torah during services. Is it the same Torah?
Yeah, I think so. Pretty sure.
Yes.
But the books, the prayer books, are obviously completely different.
Right. The five books of Moses, I think, are the same, pretty much.
Yeah. Sefer Torah is a Sefer Torah.
Yeah.
The Torahs are certainly the same, and when we lift it up, we say the Zohar Torah, Sher Sam Moshe. You know, this is the Torah that Moses gave us. Now, as I say that, you know, I am not taking that sense literally. I don't believe it literally, that this is the Torah that God gave Moses, and that Moses placed before the people of Israel. It is a metaphor for me, but it is certainly the same Torah. And I would also say that the prayer book is the same, though the Reform prayer book is certainly an edited version of what the traditional Siddur is, and the Reform prayer book will have additional readings in English or maybe even in Hebrew. But fundamentally, the Reform prayer book is clearly recognizable as having developed out of the traditional Siddur and gone through a series of transitions.
Now, the response to that is, if you don't think it's true, why would you say it?
Because I think it is true as a metaphor.
Okay, as a metaphor. Okay.
I began today introduction joking briefly about Orthodox and Reform being both sides and conservatism being left out. I'd like to frame one last question, take prerogative of moderator, to ask both rabbis to talk about, not about conservatism, but about the growth of both or identification with Reform and Orthodox Judaism, at the expense of conservative Judaism?
I think that's a very good question. See, conservative Judaism, I think, is in a very hard place right now because they want to have their cake and eat it too. You know, we understand, people can kind of understand Orthodoxy. There's a certain rule that's established, and you have to sort of follow those rules. And you have to live within those parameters if you want to define yourself as Orthodox, as what you consider to be traditional Judaism. Reform says we don't believe in revelation, as divine revelation as such. We don't see these rules as binding on the individual. Everyone has to make an individual choice. And that's the definition of Reform Judaism. To my mind, conservative Judaism wants to have its cake and eat it too. They believe in halakha. They believe in a certain path and rules and strictures. But then when they want to, when they don't find that it's really working well or it's convenient, they find a way of sort of legislating what they want to into their halakha. That doesn't work. It strikes people, I think, as false. It strikes people as disingenuous. I think that, so someone who's drawn to Reform Judaism will say, well, I'm looking for my individual choices, they'll be drawn to Reform. Someone who's drawn to a set of scriptures and a set of laws, they're going to be drawn to Orthodoxy. And someone who's in the middle, if you are more traditional minded, you have a great deal of difficulty saying, how could it be that I believe in Shabbat, but then my rabbi says I can drive in Shabbat? And if I don't have to drive on Shabbat, then why don't I just go to Reform, which says I don't have to drive, I can drive on Shabbat. And I think that we're seeing the results of that mistake that conservative movement made 50, 60 years ago today. You know, sometimes difficulties and problems rise to the top over a very long period of time. And we're seeing that today. I just saw a letter in the Jewish News the other day from a gentleman I don't know. I mean, you might have seen it a few weeks ago, saying that he's tired of going to a conservative synagogue where people talk about what they're going to do after davening. And he's tired of going to a conservative synagogue where people talk about the great restaurants that are not kosher that they ate at. Conservative Judaism believes in Shabbat almost entirely. They believe in the kashrut. They believe in very many mitzvot. And the vast majority of conservative Jews today do not follow conservative Judaism. Where does that come from? It comes from a rabbinic leadership that begins to be willing to compromise on the values of conservative Judaism and spirals unbelievably out of their control. I think when the head of the largest seminary of conservative Judaism gets up and says, we made a mistake in permitting the driving on Shabbat, that's a mistake that you can't undo 60 years later.
It is very easy for me to understand the theology and the philosophy of orthodoxy. Very easy for me. It is easy for me to understand it and to work my way through it and to appreciate how it works. I cannot do that with conservative Judaism for exactly the reasons that Rabbi Spolter said. It is wanting your cake and eating it too. And I always find it rather difficult to deal in this kind of conversation with conservative Judaism, because I'm never quite sure from where they are speaking. There's no question the source and the foundation from which Rabbi Spolter speaks. But I do have that difficulty with conservative Judaism.
I want to thank you all for coming today. Those of you who did not get an opportunity to ask questions, I do hope that we can reprise this particular morning next year to continue what was, I think, a most illuminating conversation. Please also fill out your cards so that we know who you are, and we'll find you next year to let you know more about both sides. Thank you very much.